This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
Why are so many people being locked out of their social media accounts, being banned for no real reason? Because it's being reported around the world. So what is behind this? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're hearing from those who've been left pretty frustrated and angry, I think it's fair to say, and they're demanding some answers.
Accusing me of child exploitation materials and then not being able to talk to a real person to, A, defend myself. Just really scary that, like, what, they just ban anyone's account but they don't look into it further.
Yeah, if this has happened to you, let me know. I want to know how long you were barred from your account, what the reason you were given was, and if you were able to resolve it. Message in 0439757555. Also coming up, the radio station giving hope to inmates in juvenile detention. We'll find out more about that and how it is impacting lives. First, though, housing. It's been dominating debate in Parliament today.
Hack. House prices in the month of September grew at a faster pace than at any other time in the last 2 years.
Our government has now helped 197,000 Australians get into their first home with our 5% deposit scheme.
So it was their policy that they tried to claim, then they're against it. It's all nonsense.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the government's claiming it's doing a lot. The opposition is saying the government's not doing enough. Same old arguments, right, when it comes to housing. We've been hearing them for a while, except one thing that I did spot today, which does seem like it is a little bit new. Remember last year on Hack when Housing Minister Claire O'Neill said this?
So we're not trying to bring down house prices, but we don't want to see some of the growth that we've seen in some parts of the country.
Why don't you want to be seeing house prices drop? Because if you're looking to get into the market, if you're a young person looking at what's ahead of you, you definitely want to see house prices come down.
Well, that may be the view of young people. It's not the view of our government.
Yeah, big reaction from a lot of you on that one when it went to air and a lot of people picked it up and were talking about it. We know prices are still going up all this time later. Research out just this week finding prices have risen at their fastest rate in 2 years in October. Well, now the Shadow Housing Minister, Senator Andrew Bragg, has spoken today and he said that he would like to see prices come down at an entry level. You don't often hear a politician saying that. So let's find out exactly what it means. Let's ask the Shadow Housing Minister, Andrew Bragg. Senator, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, Dave. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. I want to clear this up, though. Do you want to see house prices drop?
Well, I think in relation to first home entry-level properties, the growth in prices has been way too high. And particularly where the government has effectively forced the prices up because they've failed to build houses and they've opened up this 5% deposit scheme to everyone, I think it's only reasonable that the prices should go down to reflect that Canberra is making people's lives harder.
So by how much? How much do you reckon prices need to go down?
Well, I mean, at least the amount that the government has forced them up. Now, the Prime Minister said that the prices would only go up by 0.5%, right, on an annualised basis, we assume. Now, in the first month of the 5% deposit scheme having been changed by Labor, the prices have already gone up by 1.2% in 1 month. So, you know, at least that amount. But, like, let's see where we get to after a year of this.
Okay. I mean, you're saying entry-level prices. Can you explain exactly what you mean by that?
Yeah,
because people might be confused. One person's entry-level is another person's forever home.
I understand that. I guess what I'm saying is for a property in, I mean, as you know, the prices for houses change a lot across Australia. I mean, a first-home property in Sydney is different to what you're going to get in Darwin or Launceston in terms of the price, right? So I guess what I'm saying is, for someone who's going to buy their first house, that's an entry-level house. It might be an apartment in many cases. And so the government in Canberra has massively inflated the cost of that first house by failing to get the houses built and then by playing around with this demand-side measure. And so that's the point I'm making, because if you look at the Coality data, it shows that for the wealthiest people, their house prices aren't changing. In this month, it's jumping up at the entry-level point. So that's really the problem.
I guess the question, though, is how do you make sure those entry-level properties, as you put it, those prices are falling and allowing people to access the housing market? Like, what's the solution here? Do you have a plan to allow that to happen?
Very hard, as you know, but the idea is you need to get more houses built. So more supply will help, but also winding back some of the reckless, crazy stuff like this 5% deposit scheme, which is available to anyone without even an income or means test.
I mean, to be clear, a similar scheme was introduced by the Morrison government in 2020.
No, but it wasn't. It wasn't. It was capped and it had a means test. This one could be available to the children of billionaires. So the Labor Party have done a terrible job on housing. They've failed to build houses, and now they've got this 5% deposit scheme, which is open to anyone, and it's really cooking housing. I mean, we're seeing it in the data. This is not my data. It's not even Treasury data. I mean, by the way, we tried in the Senate today to get to the bottom of the Treasury modelling that was produced for Mr Albanese, but the government is blocking our access to it. So we can't even see what they were told. I suspect they were told before the election that, hey, if you do this, it's going to be really bad.
I mean, I guess the problem here is, Senator, that there is no quick fix, it appears.
That's
and,
right.
I mean, you're talking about supply, but that's going to take a while. The government's saying, well, look, this is something that will allow young people potentially to access the housing market who ordinarily would not have had access to the housing market. I mean, the super to buy housing scheme, the coalition's idea that they went to the election with, many experts were saying that that would also increase house prices. The government is saying that that would have dramatically increased house prices. So wouldn't we be seeing the same thing if you were in government?
Well, you've got to be very careful with demand-side measures. If you're going to have them, they've got to be targeted. Now, in this case, the 5% deposit scheme is open to anyone, including the wealthiest Australians. So I just don't understand why the taxpayer is funding a scheme for the wealthiest Australians. I mean, I get the principle that if you're a lower-income worker, there should be taxpayer support for you in particular cases. But I don't see why people are paying taxes to fund the wealthiest people to get access to a government mortgage insurance scheme. It just seems crazy to me. I don't understand it.
Do you concede that this problem has been decades in the making?
Well, the biggest problem we've had in the last few years is we've had a big growth in our population.
But what about before that? What about what led up to this? Because, you know, we can look at previous coalition governments as well and previous Labor governments, like on both sides. And I mean, it was a decade ago that Joe Hockey, the Treasurer, was telling people to just get a good job if they wanted to get a house, that was really not admitting that there was a crisis.
Well, as you probably know, under the last Liberal government, we built over 200,000 houses a year on average. Now we're down to 170,000 houses a year on average. So if you want to measure supply, we're heading backwards, and the government's wasted about $60 billion on building up bureaucracies and these sort of programs. So of course there is a shared responsibility for the overall position, but I'm pointing out to you that some of the schemes that are in the here and now are making the problem really bad. And we're seeing it in the monthly data. The data that I'm talking about today in terms of 1.2% growth in 1 month is the biggest jump in years. And this is hurting people now. So, sure, we can go back and talk about what people said 12, 15 years ago. But this is crazy stuff that's happening now, which we want to try and stop. Because if this continues, it's going to push first home ownership even further out of reach.
We've got messages coming through. Someone says, nobody wants house prices to go down. Investors want to make a profit and owners want to make money on a sale. There is zero incentive anywhere to bring house prices down. Another person says, super unclear what an entry-level house is. Another person also saying, Senator Bragg needs to clarify and articulate what entry-level housing is and how this can be achieved. It does seem like there is a lot of confusion there, Senator.
Well, I'm talking about a first home. So for most people who live in a city where if you're living in Melbourne or Sydney or Brisbane, your entry-level house is going to be a flat. It might be a one, might be a two-bedroom flat. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. I mean, what about other tax concessions that are in place now? Changes to negative gearing. I mean, they're also issues people often point to. Do you think we need to be seeing some reform there?
They point to them, but the problem with that is it it only has a very small impact on overall price. So, you know, you can increase taxes on housing, you can hit investors, but it's not going to make much of a difference in terms of the overall position. The most important thing here
is... But is a small difference enough of a difference? Like, should we be doing a whole bunch of things?
I think you've got to focus on the big things. You want to try and get the houses built, right? So you've got to work with builders, tradies, developers to get the supply side moving. And then I think you should be able to look at demand side measures on a very targeted basis. But the main game here is supply. Now, the government have housing targets for the states. Every state and territory is failing to meet their supply target. Now, we have all these weird systems in Australia where, for example, the federal government promises all this infrastructure spending for states, but they don't tie that to any housing outcome, for example. So I think there's some smart stuff we can do around making sure that the states are pulling their weight, making sure we're getting some movement, because we need to be getting about 250,000 new houses a year in Australia, and right now we're down to about 170,000. So that is really hurting us.
All right. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with the Shadow Housing Minister, Andrew Bragg, about the housing crisis, house prices specifically. On the text line, someone says, every politician should only be allowed to own one property. Any politician that's a landlord has a conflict of interest. I mean, you're laughing, but what do you think of that idea?
Yeah, it's probably a fair rule.
Okay. So there we go. A bit of agreement there. Someone says they have not.
I mean, I think if you're in public office, I mean, you've got to be mindful that everything you do, you know, could be perceived as a conflict of interest. And I just think, like, it's just good for people to have simple arrangements if they can.
Are you happy to admit how many houses you own, Senator?
Well, I've owned one, but I mean, I don't own the house. It's got mortgages.
Okay. All right. Just checking, because it's a question we always get asked when we interview politicians. Someone else says, the senator seems to forget that they held power for a long time and did nothing. What are you going to do differently?
Well, we built more houses than the government.
Yeah, so, but it's not enough, I guess. That's the issue. We don't have enough houses in Australia. No one's built enough.
Well, I agree. And look, I'm the first to admit that the former Liberal governments, in many cases, don't have a great legacy on a number of things. I would say on housing that we built a lot more houses than the current Labor Party has been able to build, despite them bragging about how great their job is.
Senator, can I ask you a couple of other things just quickly? Do you back a net zero commitment?
Well, I don't see how Australia can leave the Paris Agreement.
What if we don't leave the Paris Agreement, but there is some change that's made to remove net zero as Australia's formal target, as the Nationals have put forward?
Well, that's not how it works. I mean, Australia is not a prior state. We have to remain in the Paris Agreement because we believe in emissions reduction. We are worried about pollution. We're worried about the future. We think it's very important that we cut emissions.
So is this going to divide the coalition? Is it going to tear the coalition apart?
I don't know. I mean, there's always these open debates, aren't there? I mean, we talk about them endlessly, but we're having a debate at the moment because we've had a very heavy election defeat and we're reviewing our policies. Now, my view is that you've got to pull your weight, but you've also got to make sure that you get power prices down and keep industry on shore. But I don't think the two things are necessarily in conflict. I think you can cut emissions and you can also cut power prices and hopefully keep industry on shore.
Would you like to see opposition leader Susan Lee stay on as leader?
For sure. I definitely support Susan.
Are you worried that the coalition maybe is doing itself a bit of damage in the minds of younger voters at the moment with all this infighting?
Well, Dave, I can tell you that I'm trying very hard to hold the government to account. And like, I'm sure your listeners would agree that setting any political or individual interest aside, my job in the opposition is to hold the government to account to make sure that public money is spent properly and the programs are administered properly. Okay? Now, I'm finding that harder to do because there is this ongoing, very loud debate. And so that is making it harder to hold the government to account. So I think it is important that we get on with this and resolve it sooner rather than later.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us on Hack and answering all those questions from me, from the audience as well. Shadow Housing Minister Andrew Bragg, appreciate your time.
No worries, Dave. Thanks very much.
Hack. Like, and how can they just ban you and then not investigate when you're accusing me of something so serious and so horrible?
On Triple J.
Have you ever been locked out of your social media account? Got a message saying that you've violated some kind of terms? Because thousands of people around the world have been complaining about this for the last few months. And Alice Angeloni's been looking into it.
So I didn't have one of my good friend's numbers, but she lives down the road from me. So I literally wrote a handwritten letter and shoved it under her door. And I just felt like I was like an 1800s maiden. I'm doing pen and paper.
Mackenzie's a student in her 20s from Melbourne. And for the past 3 months, she's been forced to make some lifestyle changes because Meta, the company behind Instagram and Facebook, banned her social media accounts.
I had posted a picture of my dog just in a little blanket. He's a little chihuahua named Pablo Escobar. The next morning, I woke up to a message saying that I'd been banned because of, like, child exploitation.
Mackenzie received a message from Meta saying her account didn't follow community standards on child sexual exploitation, abuse and nudity.
I was just, like, really perplexed and just assumed I'd get my account back, like something weird had happened.
And while Instagram was a no-go, at least she still had Facebook to communicate, right?
But I didn't realize that my Facebook was connected. So they took away my Facebook too. Problem is, like, most of my family lives overseas.
Mackenzie appealed the ban and had a lawyer friend write to Meta too.
Got so desperate that I made an account, like, on my dad's phone with a made-up email, and it worked on his phone, but as soon as I try and log in on my phone, it just would not let me.
Dealing with the loss of her accounts was one thing, but the reason for the ban made things worse.
Accusing me of child exploitation materials and then not being able to talk to a real person to, A, defend myself. Just really scary that, like, what, they just ban anyone's account, but they don't look into it further? Like, if people are actually doing heinous crimes against children, shouldn't something be done?
Mackenzie's not the only one. For months, tens of thousands of people around the world have been complaining that Meta is banning their Facebook and Instagram accounts for wrongly breaching site rules. Almost 50,000 people have signed a petition accusing Meta's moderation system of wrongly banning accounts and not offering a proper appeals process. More than 200 people have contacted the ABC with their stories. Zainab was one of them.
I was selling the clothes and this was a source of income for women in Afghanistan.
Zainab is 18 and lives in Perth. She's from Afghanistan and had a business account on Instagram helping Afghan women sell their handmade clothing.
They don't have access to education anymore. They can't go out. So I was asking them to make me dresses and I was doing the modelling and marketing everything.
But about 2 months ago, Zainab woke up to a message saying her account was associated with accounts not following the community guidelines.
I appealed it and it got rejected. I emailed them so many times, nothing.
She's tried everything to get her account back, including paying to verify her personal account so she could speak to a Meta staff member and talking to Meta AI.
They were just like, everybody get their accounts banned. It's okay, don't worry. And I was like, this robot or AI doesn't understand me.
Our consumer watchdog, the ACCC, told me it's been advocating for an external dispute resolution body for big digital platforms like Meta. So why is this happening? Well, the answer's not entirely clear. On Instagram, it says AI is central to its content review process, but the tech giant has not commented on claims that Meta's AI is to blame for unfairly banning people. I asked Meta whether some users are being caught in the crossfire as it uses AI to clean up its platforms, but it didn't directly respond to that question. In a statement, a Meta spokesperson said they take action on accounts that violate their policies and people can appeal if they think a mistake has been made. I also asked Meta specifically about Mackenzie and Zainab's accounts, and this is what happened.
I have been banned for nearly 4 months now, and then you told me you'd contacted Meta yesterday. So within less than 24 hours, I got my accounts back and they were like, oh, sorry, you can use your accounts again. You did follow the guidelines.
Mackenzie wants to see better processes in place so this doesn't happen to others.
This whole experience, I've definitely grown quite disillusioned to the big social media companies. And I feel like, unfortunately, as there are so many people using the apps and we use them for free, I don't really think they care.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there and hearing from a lot of you on the text line now who've been through similar situations. Someone says, I got locked out of my account for no reason. Another person saying, you can be banned for following accounts that break the rules. Lots of interesting stories coming through. Look, let's get into this more now with Dr. Shannon Connie, a senior lecturer in cybersecurity at the University of Melbourne. He's with us now. Shannon, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Why are people having their accounts banned? What's going on?
We're seeing a lot of action right now on behalf of the social media platforms where they're trying to crack down on illegitimate behavior on their sites. So in particular, there are a lot of scams and bots and these types of accounts being created that are filling these sites with trash. So if you're Facebook, you want to take out the trash. And so what they're doing is they're automatically trying to identify which are these fake accounts. And as a result, a lot of ordinary people are being caught up in this kind of action and their accounts are being disabled, leading people to be locked out for extended periods of time while they try and sort this out.
It does feel like we're seeing more of this being reported. Do you think that is down to it being social media filled with more crap? Or do you think it is actually because the detection methods are becoming more sophisticated, that the tools that the social media companies have at their disposal are increasing as well?
So I'll give you a couple things. So the technical term for what we're seeing is actually called enshittification. Cory Doctorow coined that term and it's wonderful. And it essentially says that as time goes on, not only do the companies face pressures which make their products worse, but also the bad guys who are trying to pollute these sites for the purpose of scamming people or selling extra products or garnering outrage are also taking advantage of these platforms more and more. So there's more of that junk, which means the platforms are working harder to try and take down this kind of bad material and make and attract people to their platform so that they can sell more ads. So as part of that, you get increased action on trying to remove accounts. So that's number one. Number two is that there is a lot of regulatory action, pressure on these platforms to try and get them to reduce the extent to which people are being scammed on them. So the Australian government recently put out the scams prevention framework, which was actually passed by Parliament and came into force February this year. And while it's not yet requiring social media platforms to do anything specific, they know it's coming down the line in the next couple of months once the regulations are developed. So they're kind of getting ahead of all of this kind of government action, which is going to start requiring them to be more active in this space.
Right.
So that's another kind of lever pushing things on. And then the third thing that we're seeing is really increased ability of these platforms to do a lot of these takedowns. So as time goes on, they expand what they call their trust and safety teams, which are often the people internally dedicated to helping to detect bad actors on their platforms. And as these people develop their tools, they're constantly improving the way that they take out the trash. But you capture a million fake accounts, you're going to capture some amount of non-fake accounts in there as well. And so the real problem is balancing how do we get rid of the fake accounts while minimizing the harm to the real people that get caught up in it.
Yeah, the collateral damage, I guess, is those people who have their accounts blocked, barred, banned, and spend months without access to them. Mackenzie, who we just heard from, is one of those people. Her opinion is that these big companies like Meta just don't care. Do you think that's true?
I don't think it's true that they don't care, but the question is how much do they care and how much money are they going to spend on it? So one individual to Meta is not worth that much. It's only in bulk where our data and our presence is really worth a lot. And so the extent to which they're willing to spend to have a human review every possible dispute report is limited. And the other side of this equation that gives them a little more credit is saying, well, if regular humans can get a review by an actual person, then presumably the people running the illegitimate behavior can use that pathway as well. So if you're going to allow everyone to instantly get to a human who's going to look over their case, well, the bad guys will overwhelm that system really quickly. That being said, I think the platforms could probably do a little more to try and improve the transparency and the amount of redress that people can get when they're taken out of action, when their account is erroneously flagged. And I think that's something that the regulators are also starting to pay attention to.
So is it your guessing that things might improve in the years ahead, that as the systems become more sophisticated, the processes of reporting issues become more streamlined, that hopefully it's not as dramatic, these bans for everyday people?
Look, legitimate accounts are going to be banned for the foreseeable future, and it's possible that as the bots get better and as AI improves, the situation could get worse. But I am somewhat mollified by the fact that we're going to have these improved dispute resolution processes. And that'll probably come in the next year or two. It's a little hard to say because I thought it was going to happen this year. The Australian government passed the legislation and everyone was ready for it, but the regulations haven't been developed yet. So I imagine that is soon to come.
Good to get an insight into how, why this is all happening. Shanan Koni from the University of Melbourne, thanks very much for coming on.
Cheers.
Hack. I realised that there's an opportunity for young people to harness the time while they're inside to prepare for their future.
On Triple J.
How do you think those in youth detention should be spending their time? Do you reckon there should be a bigger focus on rehabilitation, self-improvement? Because when you're locked up, there's not much that really connects you to the outside world. And a lot of the time, it's just old sitcoms you're watching on TV or maybe a news bulletin. But a youth radio station made by people who've been through the system is making an impact. Janae Madden's been looking into it.
At just 13 years old, Jordan Carlin spent Christmas behind bars. It wasn't exactly the Christmas he wanted, but it was better than the one waiting outside.
It was wild getting socks and lollies. Like, who knew that a pair of socks would, like, make your day? But it was better than what I got on the outside. I remember thinking that. I remember thinking I didn't get shit on the outside.
Now it's been more than a decade, and the former detainee is sitting behind a microphone, not in a cell, but in a recording studio.
Well, thanks for joining us on Futures Radio. We are going to do a cons and pros episode. Hear his story, what he's been through, and how he's turned it all around.
Jordan is part of this new 24/7 radio station. It was designed by and for young people who've been through the youth justice system. It's called Futures Radio, and it's about breaking the cycle of reoffending through storytelling, music, and community. Jordan raps for the show.
Some things like the feet, but I'm burnt. I'm gonna do this, yeah, I've gotta make it earn, make myself proud.
And talks about his life. Jordan first served time as a 13-year-old. He was in and out of juvie as a teenager. At 19, he was arrested again and sent into an adult prison. He hopes that by sharing his story, he can stop others from repeating his mistakes.
I was on a fair few of the episodes, but on the very first one we were on, I explained, you know, my story and where I come from and the challenges I've had, you know, in and out of juvie, single father, grew up as a kid in foster care, that sort of stuff.
Futures Radio is based in Gosford on the Central Coast, but it's being broadcast into one of the biggest youth detention centres in New South Wales. It's called Cobham and it's located in Western Sydney. For the 105 boys that are locked up there, Jordan reckons it's something that they've never had before.
They respect what you say. They listen because, oh, he's been there, done that. And I've experienced that, you know, when I've seen someone else who's been through it, I would rather listen to them than, you know what I mean, someone who's studied a book.
Detainees like this young man, who can't be named for legal reasons, agree.
This radio show, like, it's a gift to all the boys in here because I know a lot of the boys, they just need that. They need someone that understands and someone that's been in their shoes, you know. The music, the motivational quotes, especially prayer time because I'm a religious person myself.
The idea for the station came from Dominic Brooke. He's the founder of the charity Musicians Making a Difference, and he's worked inside juvenile justice for years.
It was a moment that one of the boys said to me, he said, you know, in here I've learnt to become a better criminal. How can that be? Like, how do we harness the time and shift the culture so they're learning to be a better individual, so they're learning about how to have a great future and overcome the past?
Dominic says the team actually asked the boys what they wanted to hear.
Last week, some of the boys were like, I want a quote of the day. I want to do breath work in the morning. We can automate these beautiful programs and night reflections, meditations, cultural stories, hip hop shows. And I think they've refined it also to the music that they like. So they've got their own hour where they can request songs and it's become part of their life.
He reckons it's not just radio. For some of the boys on air, it's a completely fresh start. And for those listening, it's a way to spend their time behind bars, actually improving themselves.
We were hoping for the boys to listen to 1 hour a week. That was our big goal. And the evidence from our surveys recently is showing the boys are listening to 2 to 3 hours a day. So that's 14 to 16 hours a week.
Jordan reckons a station like Futures would have helped him a lot when he was in youth detention.
I don't think I would have gone back as many times as I did if I had, you know, futures. There's a pathway that they can follow, you know, to create their own success and stuff like that, which is incredible.
Futures Radio hopes to expand to youth justice centres across the country.
Just putting positive influence out there, you know, for them to give them the opportunity to be able and give them the chance to be able to grasp something that's positive that could change their life.
Geordie, before we start, we know the boys at Cobham love a bit of a freestyle. Yeah. Do you want to rock one for us?
Hey, do a freestyle.
Hack on Triple J.
Sinead Madden reporting there. A lot of nice messages coming through for that. Really lovely story. Also messages on people getting blocked from their own social media accounts. Someone says there's a Facebook account selling fake pets to people and using my address for their account. People have paid a deposit and they're showing up to my house looking for their pet. I've reported this on every possible platform and I can't find any help or action coming from it. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Lots of people being barred from their own accounts and not knowing what to do. That is all we've got time for on Hack.